Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. No family should have to decide between buying groceries or paying rent. No senior should have to choose between food and medicine. And no parent should have to skip a meal in order for their children to eat. Those are the messages of the Poor People's Campaign. Over the past 6 weeks, members of the Poor People's Campaign have marched on the capitals in almost 40 states. About 2,000 people have been arrested. This 40-day movement is a modern-day iteration of the Poor People's Campaign, a movement led by Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. 50 years ago. Today's Poor People's Campaign is calling for an end to systemic inequality, poverty, racism, and the war economy. On Saturday, the Poor People's Campaign is having a mass rally in Washington, D.C. And joining us to talk about the campaign and its demands are three guests. Paul Bowden is the executive director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project, a nonprofit supporting the rights of homeless people. Paul became homeless at 16 and then volunteered for a drop-in shelter. He went on to direct San Francisco's Coalition on Homelessness and later helped found the Community Housing Partnership. RAP, Western Regional Advocacy Project, worked on a list of demands sent to California legislators by the Poor People's Campaign earlier this week. And Paul Bowden joins us in studio. Hi, Paul. Thank you for coming in.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rose.
It's great to see you again. We're also joined in studio by Reverend Monica Cross. Reverend Cross is an organizer with the Women's Economic Agenda Project, which demands economic human rights for poor women and their families. She's also a member of Tapestry Ministry, an adoption and foster care community. Reverend Cross has spoken at several Poor People's Campaign events. And Reverend Cross joins us in studio. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And Desiree Kane is a Miwok and multimedia journalist, also a teacher with the Amerindian Peoples Association and the Rainforest Foundation. Desiree was one of the writers of the demand letters to California legislators, and she spent 7 months at Standing Rock. And Desiree joins us from the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota. Hi, Desiree. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I want to start off by talking about the children who've been separated from their families, because that issue is also so connected to the Poor People's Campaign. And the more that we are learning, the more shocking it is. We're now finding out that there is no mechanism in place at all to reconnect 2,300 children with their families. Yeah. In fact, in some cases, parents have already been deported without their kids. Monica, can you comment on this?
Yeah. first off, thinking about the Attorney General, particularly as a minister, as a person of faith, and as a veteran, to hear Jeff Sessions say the government is God's will to abuse people. Basically, he said, God gives permission for the government to abuse children, to create, what somebody said, a children's internment camps, mindful of the Japanese internment. It's immoral and inhumane. And, you know, U.S. foreign policy eventually comes back to bite us, such as 9/11. For years, we abused people as a nation. Our foreign policy abused people. And then, when years later, they come back and answer our abuse, then, oh, my God, what happened? And so my fear is that when you separate a child from their mother, from their parents, it's a long-term trauma. Mm. And some children, when they become adults, they may take appropriate action to address that. And then, of course, once again, you also say, oh, my God, what happened? Well, look what you did to the children, however long, 20 years ago, whatever. But there's a reckoning that takes place when we do those things.
Paul, what would you add?
I mean, I just think it's a colonizing mindset. Mm-hmm. Taking people's kids is a way, and I'm sure Desiree can speak to it a hell of a lot better than I can, but this isn't the first time this country's done this. And if we don't really tie these issues together through groups like the Poor People's Campaign, where you have the four pillars of systemic racism, systemic mm-hmm. poverty, ecological devastation, and the mm-hmm. war economy. We're going to continue to see this because they jump from place to place. Mm-hmm. Today, it's the Department of Education and the Department of Labor. Poor kids don't need an education. We're going to put them to work or we're going to put them in prison. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the mindset of neoliberalism. Yeah. Yeah. The Reagan Revolution has fully been implemented, mm-hmm. is being implemented as we speak. Mm-hmm. And it's only going to change one way, and that's when we demand that it change, not we ask that they change it.
Yeah.
Desiree, what would you add?
Well, I do agree that I have a lot to say on it, but I'll try and be succinct. This isn't the first time that this has happened. If you look at the treatment of indigenous people on this continent, we've been battling the same forces that are causing these separations of families since 1492 when, mm-hmm. you know, colonizers first stepped foot on this continent. So in order to understand what's happening, in order to digest what's happening in our world right now with the Trump administration and, you know, children being stripped away from their families, put into different facilities, look at what happened with the boarding schools here and in Canada. Mm-hmm. So if you want to understand what we have to look forward to and what we should battle, we need to be looking at that.
Yes, and I will say on a personal level, my great-grandmother was sent to an Indian boarding school in Northern California, and my grandfather was sent to a boarding school in Nevada. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, I'm seeing things like, this isn't us, this is not America. Well, people need to learn their history.
It is us.
Because
it
this is exactly what this country has done many times.
Yeah.
It's,
understanding
Oh, I'm sorry, did I interrupt?
Go ahead, Desiree.
Okay. Understanding that the United States as a nation is a resource colony. We've never moved past being a colony. We've always been colonies, right? Mm-hmm. Moving past the understanding that we are a resource colony for the global 1%. Anything that we do services this 1% who is making, I mean, there's like 2,000 something billionaires. That's who all this is benefiting, and that's who, like, we as sovereign nations are battling as indigenous people, but also now the United States civil society is starting to understand itself as a colony, and I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. You know, the Poor People's Campaign back in the day, 50 years ago, was part of a rainbow coalition of, like, all these different people and groups, the Black Panthers, the American Indian Movement, all this. The Poor People's Campaign now is the same type of rainbow coalition. So we need everyone to understand our history with open eyes. I'm really thankful to all the folks who stood beside the indigenous contingency that really turned out on June 4th at the Sacramento Capitol. Mm. Because as a Native woman, you know, you have to hold on to hope that there are thousands and thousands of people that want to be part of the solution. And the Poor People's Campaign is that, right? We're all together, like, let's focus on a solution and move past all of this because it's really hurting.
Yeah.
You know?
Desiree Kane is a Miwok, and she is a multimedia journalist. Reverend Monica Cross is an organizer with the Women's Economic Agenda Project. Paul Bowden is executive director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project. Paul, the Poor People's Campaign definitely got media at the local level, but you really had to look for it. I mean, it deserved so much more attention, given that there were arrests on a regular basis across the country. For people who might not be familiar with it, talk a little bit about the Poor People's Campaign 50 years ago and the connections to the campaign today.
Well, I mean, for the past several years, I mean, this has been building, and this isn't like, oh, let's have a demonstration or a series of demonstrations, and then we all go back our separate ways. This is the beginning of something. So the media attention that it is or it isn't getting right now in the mainstream is not as important as looking at all of the organizations that are connecting to it. And the demo, I was fortunate to go to Eureka, where they were doing a solidarity action. There's actions in 40 different states, mm-hmm. right? So it's learning from what happened 50 years ago. It's learning from why that disbanded, not just the assassination of Martin Luther King, but there were other reasons why it disbanded. Mm-hmm. And we have to learn from that in order to get stronger and to build our strength to reach the point of actually achieving our demands. Mm-hmm. And so there is an incredible energy and collectiveness. There's 500, 600 people in Washington, D.C. right now just preparing for the action that's going to happen on the 23rd, where they're anticipating 20 to 30,000 people. Mm-hmm. So that, and it's not just the people coming to this action. That's what's so important in here, the moral fusion of connecting these issues. Mm-hmm. I used to think that was kind of a dorky term, you know. It's just, I'm from the streets. Like, that's right? Just not the way we talk. But it as this has built and as we have grown with this and seeing how it's resonated with connecting our issues into a human rights-focused effort, and a human rights change for demand for change. It's been a beautiful experience working on it.
Mm. And Monica, what would you add? The New Yorker had a really nice profile of the Reverend William Barber.
They did.
And in North Carolina, there have been the Moral Monday rallies for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
And so this really has been building over time.
Yeah, it has been building. It's interesting because, I mean, I'm not, I can add too much to what Paul said because that was it.
I would
only add that the tools of social media and a lot of my my colleagues are kind of underground, and they chime into a lot of what's going on. So, you know, you may not see it in the national, because, you know, the media is owned by corporations. And so corporations control what people see. So a lot of time, somebody says the revolution will not be televised. I mean, it's just like that.
Mm-hmm.
And William Barber is coming from a point of faith, and faith is very much an underground thing. Yeah, that's all I have to add, really.
And when William Barber talks about the moral revival component of the work, his organization, Repairs of the Breach, makes the argument that the big moral public concern should not be prayer in public schools, abortion, mm-mm, property rights, the list goes on, but instead focusing on the poor, women, LGBTQ people, children, workers, immigrants, communities of color, people who are not,
people who are struggling, people with disabilities. Yeah, I mean, I think of him a lot. When I drive down the street, I see more and more homeless people.
Mm.
Not just, it used to be, I would just see men on the streets. Now I see whole families across the racial spectrum. I mean, it's like, wow. So then when the Poor People Campaign tries to address that situation, I think sometimes that it's very challenging because we push and then the opposition goes further. So with the Trump administration, they have no ethics at all. Sometimes I think that we have to almost be more and more radical in order to make the change that we need to change.
Let's talk about some of the numbers. According to research from UC Davis, 43 million Americans lived below the poverty line in 2017. Right now, that's defined by an income of about $15,000 a year for one person and $26,000 a year for a family of three. Paul, we hear these numbers. We hear about poverty and extreme poverty. What are we really dealing with right now in this country? I mean, you work in this. You see this every day. I mean, you're out on the streets talking with people every day in one of the wealthiest cities in the country.
I mean, 35 years since the advent of contemporary homelessness, but it goes way further back than that. And, you know, and Desiree, I'm sure, can speak to what's happening in native lands. Mm-hmm. It's brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And the understanding needs to grow and needs to be heartfelt. Poverty is systemic oppression. And it's about rich get richer while the poor starve. And the thing with the Poor People's Campaign and bringing it into a human rights context, the UN Rapporteur's visits that were just done from both housing and extreme poverty, like it, understanding that this is a human rights framework.
Yeah.
And yeah, the Poor People's Campaign is led by two reverends, the co-chairs. You know, people always talk about Reverend Barber, but there's the leadership is from within the communities. Mm-hmm. The work mm-hmm. is within the communities. The last thing poor people need is another leader. We've got way too many leaders. We need soldiers. We need to be on the ground in our community, living and breathing and believing what it is that we do every day and that we're right. There is a righteousness in having a moral debate and having a moral discussion, and we need to embrace that. We need to feel entitled to say we want a government, our government, that values education, values health care, values a living wage, and values a decent place to live for all people, regardless of where they were born, regardless of the color of their skin, regardless of their belief systems, that human beings are entitled to decency and respect. And that's the demand from a moral basis.
And that's the demand, Desiree. Again, I know I repeat this a lot, but we do live in one of the wealthiest cities in the country, and yet we have a homeless crisis. I ran into a woman last night who's lived on the streets for about 12 years, and she's in her 60s. What would you like to add from the perspective coming from Indian country?
Well, you know, these issues that are being experienced, like right now I'm up in North Dakota. I spend a lot of time here, especially, you know, before and after Standing Rock, the movement of the place. But a lot of these issues, I think, the decisions are being made in the state capitals. And so that's why the Poor People's Campaign is aimed at the state capitals. Even for Indian country, a lot of decisions are made there that affect us that we're not allowed into that system, into how those decisions are being made. We're locked out of voting by gerrymandering. Like, there's just a whole bunch of things going on. And so the system, we have to work with it as Native people and Native nations that have sovereign, or that are sovereign and have treaties with the United States. We have to start working with the government. And I hate to say that. I'm a pretty radical activist. You know, I was out on the front lines of Standing Rock. But someone, our friends, those that share the same ideologies, we've got to get up into those state capitals and have an inside-outside strategy with the front lines. Paul is right that we have so many more people than there ever will be, you know, leaders or overseers or government. So embracing that for the Poor People's Campaign is incredibly empowering, I've found, as a Native person, because it's not very often that you walk into a space of likely allies and are so warmly embraced. So when you talk about poverty, you know, I think about our reservations and what's going on there. We have missing and murdered Indigenous women thousands a year that aren't paid attention to because the system's broken. We've got people that freeze to death every year because the system's broken. We have to fix the system. And unfortunately, that means working with it, no matter how much we don't like it.
If I could chime in, because one of the things, a couple of years ago, there were some meetings in Baltimore to start putting together what is now the Poor People's Campaign. And it was deliberately groups from all different, you know, issue areas, for lack of a better word. And there really was this mutual respect that no issue is more important than any other issue. And that, you know, the old union adage, an injury to one is an injury to all, was actually being carried out. And when you start the organizing and the planning for coming together at that level, from the very first days of all of our issues are equally important because we're all human beings and we all deserve respect, you can actually create the change that we so desperately need to see happen.
What would you both say in response to Desiree's comment about working on the inside and the outside, having both of those strategies? Monica?
It's necessary because if change is going to come, you have to have an inside person. So as an example, so as a transgender person, I do my work in the communities of faith, and it's some hard work. God, hard work. But I do that work. But then I have my colleagues that work outside the church. Because you can't just do one or the other. It's got to be both. Because the decisions, so when you look at the Congress, when you look at these legislative structures, they're controlled by corporations. I remember when I was in the military, I was stationed at the Pentagon in a very different world. And everybody I saw on Capitol Hill who had a suit on was actually a corporate sponsor. Even, I love Barbara Lee to death, but the corporations go visit her too. So you have to have somebody on the inside to address that situation, to make sure a different perspective is heard. Meanwhile, on the outside, you have to build critical mass on the outside. So then when you have your protest, you have people on the inside who can actually hear the people on a protest. If you do it one or the other, then it's harder to get done, if at all. Mm. Because they're not going to hear. They hear the corporation. They hear McDonnell Douglas. They hear the Trump Corporation. Right. Particularly now, they don't hear. Yeah, so you have to do it from both ends.
Paul?
I'd take a somewhat different
track.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I just think that we have to change how the inside functions. Just taking people that are decent people, and, you know, I'm sorry, I feel like I've seen this play before. Taking people who are different people and putting them into a corrupt system and thinking that that's going to change the system has not been successful. I'm not, and luckily we're not a consensus organization.
Right.
So if this is how people want to move, I'll support it.
Yeah.
But I have a real aversion to seeing the corrupting influence of people getting into positions of power that are then going to rep us. I have seen that fall by the wayside way too many times. I have seen people that have had strong community support to get into a position of power, and then all of a sudden that money influence and that corporate influence and all the butt-kissing that happens to politicians with the – you walk around Sacramento, you walk around D.C., you walk around City Hall, any City Hall. Who walks around those buildings as if they freaking own it? It's the lobbyists and the corporations. And then the poor people come in and they ask for stuff. They don't. I think we need to change that sense of entitlement and that sense of you work for me, sucker. This is what we put you here for. And then we can talk about an inside-outside strategy.
Desiree, when you brought up the inside-outside strategy, I was thinking about some of the Native women that are running. We might have our first ever Native woman Congress member, Deb Haaland from New Mexico. It was shocking when I mean, I'm not surprised, but still shocked that there's never been a Native
first
woman serving
ever
in Congress, and this is the year 2018.
Wow.
Yep. I mean, for the last election cycle, the first Native woman got an electoral college vote as well with Faith Spotted Eagle out of North Dakota as well. So there is a different tide that is coming because I think folks are starting to agree that we do have to change how the inside works, right? So when I said inside-outside strategy, I do agree that we have to have people who are inside to hear what the folks on the outside have to say. I was more thinking and saying along the lines of like doing actions and taking action against the people that would hear us, you know, protesting them visibly like we have continued to do until we either get people that are willing to infiltrate and change from within and do that work from within, or we're going to have an inside outside where we keep doing and shutting down like direct, you know, doing direct actions inside capitals and shutting them down for the day, hollering because there's no other way to be heard. Right, it falls on deaf ears. We've seen this Alinsky model of organizing where, you know, you go, like Paul said, ask. The time for asking is over. We already tried that. They already have developed tactics against that. So we have to, as a poor people's campaign, and just as the people's, you know, civil society, have to say, like, this isn't working. We're going to throw our bodies into the gears of injustice and, like, stop it. People put their bodies in front of trains and all sorts of things to stop injustice. So expecting actions at capitals, at lobbying firms, like those very lobbyists that he was talking about that run around like they own everything in, like, no rest until we get justice. I look to some really inspiring actions that I've seen. It was a while ago called Black Brunch, where Black Lives Matter activists would just go up into places that were known to have unjust workforce practices, we'll say they're racist or whatever, and they would shut down the business. like, capitalism runs this place. We have to stop the stop being cogs in a wheel and start being, like, a bolt that gets thrown into the whole mechanism that just stops the whole machine. I don't know that we can do that individually, but I know a lot of us collectively doing that can. So.
Today we're joined by Desiree Kane, Reverend Monica Cross, and Paul Bowden, and we are talking about the Poor People's Campaign. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Every living former First Lady has called out the practice of family separation at the southern border.
These actions are an affront.
Hillary Clinton, Rosalind Carter, Laura Bush, and Michelle Obama broke protocol and called the policy cruel and immoral. The latest on the border crisis and the power of the people close to the Oval Office with presidential author Kate Anderson Brower. Next time on 1A.
You can hear 1A at 11 o'clock right after your call here on KALW. This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. You can also post a comment or a question on the website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will discuss right-wing governments waging a war on refugees from Italy to the United States. We'll talk about Italy's refusal to rescue boats carrying hundreds of migrants, and we'll also talk about widespread outrage over the Trump administration's policy of separating children from their parents. That's tomorrow. Today we are talking about the Poor People's Campaign. Over the past 6 weeks, members of the Poor People's Campaign have marched on the capitals in almost 40 states. 2,000 people have been arrested. But this has really been a multi-year campaign. You might remember we did some shows about Moral Mondays in North Carolina. This Saturday, there's going to be a mass rally in Washington, D.C., and the campaign is calling for an end to systemic inequality, poverty, racism, and the war economy. Today, we're joined by Paul Bowden, Executive Director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project, a nonprofit supporting the rights of homeless people. Reverend Monica Cross is an organizer with the Women's Economic Agenda Project. They demand economic human rights for poor women and their families. Desiree Kane is a Miwok woman and multimedia journalist. She is a teacher with the Amer Indian Peoples Association and the Rainforest Foundation. She also spent 7 months at Standing Rock. And you can join us. Many, many issues to discuss here. Sadly, the numbers of poor people in the United States are just massive. In fact, the UN Rapporteur was recently here, and he is going to be delivering a speech and a video to the Human Rights Council tomorrow. Is that right, Paul?
Yeah, tomorrow in Geneva, he'll be presenting his findings and report that he wrote from his visit to the United States back in December.
You were with him for part of this trip.
Yeah, we set up street outreaches and community forums on a multitude of issues, even though we come from the street, in Skid Row and in San Francisco, both. And we were incredibly honored that the Right to Rest Act, which decriminalizes sitting, standing, laying down, sleeping, and eating for all people, not just homeless people. We wrote it, but it impacts everybody because we've seen those kind of loitering laws used to criminalize people under sundown town, Jim Crow, Antioquia. Yeah. We've seen these laws used to criminalize the presence of people. He mentioned it in his report, highlighted it in his report as a human rights-based approach to addressing the issue of homelessness, and we were pretty jazzed to see that.
Wow. He's going to be also presenting a video tomorrow, and this video points out that the United States has one of the largest poverty rates in the Western world, and when you look at inequality, it surpasses most other wealthy countries.
Yeah, and he wrote and articulated what we have known for years, and
right.
and the fact that the U.S. withdrew from the commission, from the UN commission, right before this report was coming to that commission, tells you that this isn't news. It's just now we're getting it in an international front, that behind the TV commercials and this facade of America was founded on colonizing, so the impact and what we're seeing is based on a history of colonizing and neoliberalism, and that's what he basically says in a very nice dweeby sort of academic UN rapporteur way. He's calling the United States a bunch of racist, classist, neoliberal mongers.
In his report, the U.S. has the highest income inequality in the Western world, as the government spends $1.5 trillion on tax cuts for corporations and the ultra-wealthy. It was so interesting to watch the rapporteur on poverty and the rapporteur on housing come to San Francisco and other parts of the country, but they were floored by what they saw here.
Yeah, the rapporteur on housing, Lalani is her name, but she was invited. We had to invite her. UC Berkeley actually wrote the invitation. The Philip Alston, the rapporteur on extreme poverty, was actually here as a UN rapporteur site visit, and they were both blown away. And he writes very articulately about the native lands that he visited, about down south, and really both seemed struck by the thousands and thousands and thousands of people in the Bay Area and down in Skid Row that are literally living out in the street. While, we talk about the income disparity issues, there's also, we subsidize housing as a country. $144 billion a year is going into subsidizing home ownership type housing because it benefits the mortgage companies, the real estate interest, and the banks. We don't subsidize housing for poor people, $34 billion a year. We're going to be cutting it. We're going to be increasing the rents. We have work requirements. All of these things in place because we call it charity for poor people. Where you were born, if you've ever been a felony conviction, you're not qualified. None of that pertains to the housing that is subsidized for home ownership.
Nope.
None of it. So it's strictly a class-based issue. Yeah. And racism is a class-based issue.
Yeah.
Monica?
Only thing I add, because Paul's eloquent.
He tells it like it is. No, they won't let me curse, so I have to say it this way.
I mean, I've come to the point I just say it's a huge plantation.
It is.
It's just all it is. I mean, the center of American wealth was the plantation owner. And it really hasn't changed. That whole process is still in place, and they use divisions to get people, oh no, we're gonna be all right, I'm not black, or it's gonna be all right, I'm not gay. They use those kind of issues to ensure that their plantation still exists. But it's and the thing is, this is where you get the moral injury with military personnel, because they realize what they're defending is is injustice. I'll just say that. And so what happens is a lot of people have mental health issues because they realize we're defending poverty. We're defending a system that impoverishes more and more people. And then people have used drugs to somehow cope. Just a huge plantation.
Mm. Right. In fact, we need to do a show about the opioid crisis that's been on our list for a little bit, for a while now, and it keeps getting bumped off. Desiree, you were one of the writers of the demand letters to California legislators. Yeah. And we talked about the main demands, an end to systemic inequality, poverty, racism, and the war economy. In fact, speaking of the war economy, let's talk about this for a minute, Desiree. Because of all of the outrage over the Trump administration's deportation policy and separating kids from their parents, this really didn't get much attention. On Monday, the Senate, by a vote of 85-10, voted to give the military $716 billion for the year 2019. Only 8 Democrats voted against it.
Yep. It's two wings to the same bird. So, I mean, of course.
And then right after this came out, Paul Ryan, of course, is still talking about wanting, you know, cuts to health care, retirement mm-hmm. security, education, infrastructure, and other crucial services. So you're having these two things come uh-huh. out on the same week that this is going on, and it just didn't get as much attention.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think that a lot of people who did not vote for Trump knew that a lot of this stuff was going to happen. I was up at the Standing Rock occupation camp, Olsheti Shakoin camp, when the election announcement came out for Trump. And all of us just kind of had this collective like tenseness in our chest because we knew that Morton County, the police jurisdiction that brutalized a lot of people and then got a lot more people brutalized by more police, would be then further empowered by the Trump administration. Mm. That kind of money going to a military mechanism should honestly terrify all of us. Mm. It should be, that should be scary. They will attack us. They have shown that they'll attack us. They have in the past. They will in the future. They'll use dogs. We have been... lucky is the wrong word that we haven't been bombed our own cities, but the police pull guns on us. They kill us. Like, that much money going to the government more, like to the military specifically, is really scary. Mm. And it should concern all of us because it impacts our bodies.
You know, we talk about, Desiree, we talk about the criminalization of the poor, and we just recently learned that Michael Littlefeather Giron, who was arrested in October at Standing Rock and has been in jail for 1 year, was sentenced to another 3 years in prison. Can you give us an update on people who were arrested at Standing Rock?
Yeah, so we are just past the two-thirds mark of all of the 700-plus court cases that arose out of that, you know, from people being arrested. Littlefeather, who you just mentioned, is a friend of mine. He has a little bit of a different past, right, than others would. He's had a more difficult past, and that system being weighed against him because of that past. He is now... he pled, right? So what happens, and it is happening with Standing Rock, is the system and the government has more money, so they're doing things like litigious harassment. I think about Red Fawn, who's got her trial, I'm sorry, her sentencing hearing on June 25th. That woman, the FBI paid a guy to go into camp, form a duplicitous relationship with her, so now we have non-consensual sexual relationship initiated by the government to get information out of a lady at camp. And instead of her going through the court system, like, I understand why she would do this, right? Instead of going through the court system, winding up facing however long, because she was set up by the FBI, literally, she's like, you know what, I'm just going to plead. I want to get back to my family. Like, I don't want to be in jail for 15 years because they do hyper-criminalize Native women and men specifically. I'm just going to plead and, like, just try and keep my head down. You know what I'm saying? So we've got a number of those sorts of high-profile trials that are playing out. We've got another one with a man called Brendan Nastasio, Bravo One. He's the one that was criminalized for stopping a man with an AR-15 that was coming towards a camp of thousands of unarmed protesters. Mm. So there are a lot of like high-profile things that are continuing to play out, but we also have just your everyday person who got a, disrupting a governmental function for being on a road, a public road, exercising your freedom of speech as a like a citizen. Mm. And a lot of those are getting kind of either dismissed or, you know, if there's a photo of them, like, standing on the road, then, you know, because, ooh, standing on the road, it'll be like, if you don't get in trouble for another year, we'll drop these charges.
Mm. Are a number of people from Standing Rock involved in the Poor People's Campaign?
Well, it's kind of a sprinkling, right? We do need more Native representation with the Poor People's Campaign, but we're like barely 2% of the population. So I think we have about the same representation. Mm-hmm. In Sacramento on June 4th, we had a young man named Jesse James White. He's a youth from Standing Rock who just, you know, there was a time when there was a lot of recognition happening, and just because he's a young man, he's like 20, and he didn't jump in front of cameras or anything, he was not really recognized. So he was a big part of leading the song and the prayer that happened within the Capitol and outside the steps on that day. So what's really important is that looking for the people, asking like, oh, you know, where are the Native youth? And that's what the Poor People's Campaign has done really well.
Desiree.
We've also got we have Joy Braun too. She's kind of a powerhouse out of there. So
Desiree Kane spent 7 months at Standing Rock, and she is with the Amerindian Peoples Association and the Rainforest Foundation. Reverend Monica Cross is an organizer with the Women's Economic Agenda Project. Paul Bowden is ED of the Western Regional Advocacy Project. And today we're talking about the Poor People's Campaign, calling for an end to systemic inequality, poverty, racism, and the war economy. The United States has the highest income inequality in the Western world, as the government is spending $1.5 trillion on tax cuts for corporations and the wealthy. And then just on Monday, the Senate overwhelmingly voted to give the military, which does not include health benefits, this budget, $716 billion. It was an 85-10 vote. Only 8 Democrats voted against it, including Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Dianne Feinstein, Bernie Sanders, an independent. Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey actually voted for the measure.
Really?
So he did. If you have any questions or comments about the Poor People's Campaign, we'd love to hear from you. Tackling income inequality, tackling poverty, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Head over to our Facebook page, KALW, click on the video there, and then join the conversation. All right, let's talk about some of the demands. The letter that has been sent to the California legislature points out that the state of California has 111 billionaires. At the same time, the poor are getting poorer. Incomes at the bottom 10% of Californians have dropped by a whopping 26% since 2007.
Wow.
So when you all got together to talk about demands, tell us what those conversations sounded like. Monica?
At the WEEP level, in order to get the demands engaged, we started having teach-ins at Laney College to build that mass appeal, to somehow educate people, educate students, what it looks like. As an example, getting people out to vote. It's a huge issue because a lot of folks don't trust that their vote's going to matter. And that goes a large part to trying to get these demands met, because if you can somehow vote the right people in, then somehow, even with the complications of the whole process, somehow getting those demands met. It's a long-term process to get them done. And a lot of our students are poor. A lot of our students don't have food to eat. They go to shelters. They go to food pantries trying to figure a way to get it. And then in order to go to school, some have to take loans out just to go to school because school is so expensive. And so doing teach-ins, we deal with, as an example, one student says, why should I vote the Electoral College is going to make the final decision? So we had to go through a process of really explaining to this particular student the origin Electoral College, you know, slaveholders and stuff. So the demands that just for a better life for everybody, it really does begin at a grassroots level and teaching people how important it is to vote, even with the complexity of all that matters. And ensuring that we have a long-term strategy. Because these demands, slavery only ended after a long struggle and battle to get it abolished. So I think a lot of these demands are a long-term issue. That's kind of where I am.
Yeah. Desiree, what would you add on the demands?
I think, you know, the point that slavery was ended after a long battle is accurate. When you have people, all of whom, you know, myself included, are like, very attached to our community, our people, the things that the folks who are accountable to need us to be vocal about. I really liked the process, right? Because I care to build people power. And so seeing how everybody brought what, or everyone continues to bring what they need represented to the table, that mutual respect between people, that nobody's issues are the most important, but that we're all here to fight these big issues together as kindred, as all relations, has been, for me, it's pushed my political analysis. And I think that personally, that's something I'm responsible to do as an educated, you know, member of society. Like, I need to understand all these different positions. I can, you know, make my own in an informed, caring way. That's my responsibility. And so having people that share that principle has been, I mean, I've found like a whole other family, right? And when I see people that I've known from like my high school, they're in Michigan organizing the Poor People's Campaign, that's like reigniting old community relationships and fostering those, you know, because they reach out like, oh my God, I'm doing this in California, you're doing it in Michigan. There's just so many connections that connect us all to being all nations. You know, we're all relations, and like fighting under that viewpoint is truly beautiful. I think there's a lot of pain that we're all processing out together, and being able to let our guard down a little bit and talk to each other about what's the pain points of our communities, ourselves, and have them heard and to be seen, and to have other people that are like, that hurts me too, like, let's do something about it. It gets you pumped up and engaged. And people, we want to be engaged, because you can't just watch social media all the time and take in all that bad news, because that's all we see, a lot of bad news, without doing something. And so if that hurt, if you're feeling that, like, come join us, because the thing to offset that, like, oh my God, our world is crumbling, is to, like, come build up with us. Like, don't crumble.
One of the demands is establish the right to housing for all. And cities across the country have a huge problem with the cost of housing. Paul, here in California, according to CalMatters, 70% of poor Californians see the majority of their paychecks go immediately to rent. Landlords freely refuse to rent to people who depend on housing vouchers like Section 8 or people who have prior convictions. What kind of solutions would you like to see around this housing battle, this housing crisis, especially as we're about to get a new mayor in this city?
I think it's in the context of the Poor People's Campaign, I think it's incredibly important to realize that when we talk about human rights, housing needs to be at the forefront of that. I mean, it's just to think of it as a commodity. You know, the Harvard just put out a study. There's been studies we did without housing. We've got some cool posters about it. Like, this, none of this is new.
Right.
And, you know, like, to think that, you know, the most rising rents, the highest rent expenditures are now in poor neighborhoods because we have the reverse white flight. And now all the grandkids of those suckers that moved out to the suburbs want to move into the city. And part of gentrification is the displacement of poor people. It's not just about making the streets look better. Like, it's 16th and Cap. You know, this elementary school's been there forever. Now all of a sudden there's speed bumps in front of it, and there's an extra light put in on 16th Street where there wasn't a stoplight before. Gee, isn't that interesting? Poor kids been going to that school forever. Now that that neighborhood's gentrifying, we're worried about the safety of the children. So, you know, this isn't an economic argument. Right. This is a human rights argument. And the blatant racism and classism that plays itself out. Housing isn't expensive. Corporations making money to build housing is what makes it expensive. Housing is a non-entity. It's just a piece of wood or a piece of metal or a piece of concrete. Like, housing is cool. I've been without it and I've been with it, and I'll take with it every single day. So when they talk about the choiceful and the service resistant and all these labels, you know, the Farrell, when he was in there, interim mayor of San Francisco, he used the Trump line in justifying the sweeps that are happening throughout the city and referring to homeless people as rapists. He used that line in the Chronicle, and no one else called him on it.
He called homeless people rapists?
He said that he was protecting the women from rape by getting rid of the tents.
Wow.
That's what was going on in the tents. Now, this is blatant. This is not, and you know, this, what we're seeing with Trump, which is like Reagan on steroids, but when you think Reagan to Trump, that actually the line makes sense. And when you look at Hope 6, and when you look at these housing choice vouchers that now you see in all of the listings for rentals, no Section 8, no Section 8, no Section 8. The housing choice is the choice of the landlord. It's not the choice of the poor person with that worthless piece of crap voucher that they've been given.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we, that was Clinton. That was Clinton. So, you know, we're not just, we're talking about a systemic issue here. Trump is the one that's in the White House today. He's going to do his steroid version of implementing these kind of changes. That military budget wasn't for the military. It was for McDonnell Douglas and Blackwater and General Electric and Northrop Grumman. That's why there's so much money in that military budget. Eisenhower would be rolling over in his grave right now. He was a Republican general, and he called the military-industrial complex the greatest threat to the democracy of this country.
Right.
We are, when you look at neoliberalism, how it played out through the United Fruit Company, what then got labeled Banana Republics, they didn't have local police departments. They had military.
Yeah.
We're in the same boat. Yeah. We are militarizing our police department, and pretty soon you won't be able to tell the difference. There won't be a local police department. There'll be a military that oversees, shoots, and kills poor people.
Yeah, you know, as you're saying
that,
two things. One, in Richmond, we've been fighting really hard and fast against gentrification. The city council passes budgets to support renters, rent control, these kind of things. And then the corporations come by and they run a lawsuit against us. And so Richmond is really pushing back. And it's, for a lot of folks, Richmond is that last place they can afford. Because Silicon Valley rolled down through San Francisco, through Oakland, and then now you've got Richmond. The other part, and it's really small, how gentrification can creep. So I noticed that we started seeing bikes in our different neighborhoods. So as the gentrification went forward, now they put bike racks on the corners. So it's really steady. But and of course, a lot of my friends now have had to move out of Richmond or out of Berkeley because they can't afford it.
Where are they going?
Some are moving out of the state.
Reverend Monica Cross is an organizer with the Women's Economic Agenda Project. They are demanding economic human rights for poor women and their families. Paul Bowden is executive director of RAP, a nonprofit supporting the rights of homeless people. Desiree Kane is with the Amerindian Peoples Association and the Rainforest Foundation. She's a Miwok woman who spent 7 months at Standing Rock. Desiree, Monica, and Paul, thank you all for joining us.
Thanks, Rose.
Thank you.
Thank you. This Saturday, the Poor People's Campaign is having a mass rally in Washington, D.C. You can find more information about it at yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. From Italy to the United States, right-wing governments are waging a war on refugees and immigrants. We will talk about media coverage. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.